Blog Talk Radio.
Look out, evildoers! There is a new crime fighter in town! Here comes the Blue Roofie!
Unhand her, criminal scum! Prepare to be brought to justice! But first,
can I buy you a drink?
Alright, we're on the air. This is the V-Spot. I'm Dr. Victator. I tell you, that's going to be a dang good show whenever it airs. I'm having my guest tonight is Glenn Roof. He was Thrasher of the Headbangers. How you doing, Glenn?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Was and still is. we're not done yet. We got some more left in us. So keep an eye out. You might see us soon.
All right. You know, I remember the first time I saw you. You were working on the early Raw episodes at the Manhattan Center.
Yep, I was on the very second show ever from of Monday Night Raw against Marty Jannetty. Yep, I was doing enhancement work. Absolutely.
All right. How long had you been wrestling at that point?
Probably maybe 6 months, something like
how
that. Back then it was when you were in a wrestling school. I went to the Monster Factory, Poor Boy Larry Sharp, and this is when WWF just wrestled up and down the East Coast. So a lot of their TV shows were from the Manhattan Center and, you know, up and down the East Coast. So we always used to be the ones selected to go, you know, from the wrestling schools and stuff like that. So that's how we managed to step into that. I was in there with Dwayne Gill and Barry Hardy and, you know, Russ Goldberg and all them guys.
How were you treated when you would do these? Because, you know, you never really hear from the guys on the other side. Were you treated as an enhancement worker? Were you treated well by the other wrestlers?
I mean, it was the fact that you were up there, you knew what your job was. Your job was to make these guys superstars, who they were. So, I mean, you know, how did they treat us? They treated us pretty good because, you know, we do one thing wrong, you know, when we're out there in the ring with them, and, you know, it kind of messes them up also. So they treated you pretty good. And, you know, that it's a respect factor in the business. You know, guys that are just learning the business and stuff like that, you know, come up through that way of getting their, you know, their asses kicked and everything else. Because I was always told it's a lot harder to make it look believable getting your ass kicked than kicking somebody's ass. That's the easy part. So, you know, it was a give and take. I mean, no, it was we were treated really good. I mean, you know, I don't have anything bad to say. You know, they didn't make us dress out in the locker. You know, they didn't make us dress outside or, you know, in the boiler room or anything else like that. You know, it wasn't like that.
All right. Now, I know in an early episode you wrestled the Steiners.
Yes.
How were they to work with?
Oh, they were fine. I mean, they were, you know, it's funny because, you know, you talk to some people and they're like, oh, my God, the Steiners, they were so stiff back then and everything else. That's the way I was trained to wrestle. I was trained to, you know, be tight, as we call it, and stiff and whatnot. But, you know, I never had a problem with them. You know, I went out there and did what I had to do for them. And, you know, it was fine. It was, you know, was it a little bit more snug than some people? Of course it was. They were the Steiners. I mean, when you took a Steiner line, it was, you knew it. You definitely knew it.
When did you meet Mosh?
I was training down at the Monster Factory, I became the head trainer down there, and I trained several guys. And he came through the school as a trainee, and we just hit it off real well. You know, we knew of each other before the school because we both went to, you know, our towns were right next to each other. He wrestled in high school. I wrestled in high school. He graduated a year after I did. So we kind of knew of each other, but we didn't really know each other. And, you know, we just hit it off really good when he came down to school. You know, he was probably the last, I guess, name guy I trained. You know, one, the other two that everybody will know is D'Lo Brown and also Paul White, which everybody knows him as the Big Show.
All right. How did you do you remember when you met Paul White?
It was down the Monster Factory. It was way before he, you know, went to WCW and stuff like this. This is when he first got into wrestling. I don't remember the year exactly or anything else. It might have been, what's it, 93, 92?
How athletic was he when he first started?
It was funny because he was extremely athletic. The story we got when he came down to the wrestling school is that he was in the Boston Celtics farm team for basketball. So he was being groomed to be an NBA basketball player. And I don't know if Paul liked that or wanted to always get into wrestling. I don't know. But I know that guy, he was so incredibly athletic. When he first came down, I mean, he was 7'2". He was probably right around between 350 and maybe 375. So he was a lot leaner than he is now. And, you know, he was just – his vertical leap was huge back then. So he was incredibly athletic. I mean, and he still is to this day. I mean, you got to figure somebody 7'2" to do what he's been doing for the number of years he's been doing it. The guy's gifted. I mean, this is plain and simple.
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, I'll look at some of the things he does, you know, and I just think about, you know, like if I just come off a step wrong, you know, I feel like my knees are going to break.
There you go.
Now, when did you decide to start teaming with Mosh, whose name, Chaz, that's his name. I couldn't remember it for the life of me.
It was weird because, you know, what Larry Sharp used to do down at the Monster Factory, he would have school shows, you know, once a month. He would bring in a top name from, you know, WWF at the time or, you know, WCW or, you know, just a local big name. So, you know, through the first 2 years of me being in the business, you know, Chad started back in 93 or 94. And, you know, I got to meet, you know, Jim Cornette, Jerry Lawler, you know, all these guys had, you know, wrestling promotions in different states where they were territories and you could actually go there and wrestle, you know, 4, 5, 6 nights a week. And, you know, I always had an invitation through Jerry Lawler and Jim Cornette, you know, to go down. But, you know, you've always heard the horror stories about, you know, you go down there and you starve and it's, you know, hard to live down there by yourself and blah, blah, blah. So it was something I never wanted to do by myself. So, you know, after, you know, the 2 years or so that I've, you know, tried to do it on my own, he just came down. We just started talking and, you know, one thing led to another and there it was. It was probably the most natural thing that I think has ever happened to me in wrestling. It just felt like, you know, all the moves that he was doing in the ring, it reminded me of myself, you know, when I first started and everything else. It was just right. You could just, you knew. It's hard to explain. It's just one of those feelings, kind of like when you meet that right girl. You just know. I don't want to, you know, compare him to a woman or nothing, but you know, he is my longest relationship I've had. So,
when did you come up with the gimmick for the Headbangers?
Actually, we did not come up with it. We were wrestling in hoods, and we were called the Spiders, and we were down at USWA for Jerry Lawler wrestling as the Spiders, and you know, our time there, you know, was coming to a close. And so I contacted Jim Cornette and said, hey, Jimmy, you know, we're finishing up over here at USWA. Do you have anything for us over there? He's like, you know, Glenn, I really love you guys. You know, I love, you know, your whole team and what you guys are doing, but I just can't stand the masks. He goes, if we can do something without the hoods on, that would be great. So, you know, a couple days later, he calls us up. He goes, listen, he goes, I went to this heavy metal concert. Now, mind you, we've always had the tattoos and the piercings and, you know, everything else. He's like, I went to this heavy metal concert and I saw all these guys with these tattoos and the piercings and all this stuff. And they, you know, they were spitting on each other and they were listening to that god-awful music that you guys listen to and everything else. He goes, it was it was like a headbanger's ball. He goes, and that's where I came up with it. He goes, I'm going to call you guys the headbangers, Mosh and Slasher. And we were like, well, Jimmy, there's a guy in a band called Slash. I don't think that would be a great name. And he goes, all right, Thrasher. So Jim Cornette came up with the name, the Headbangers, Mosh and Thrasher.
Okay. Now, I remember back in 1995, this is back when I was buying all the magazines, and you guys popped up a few times.
Uh-huh.
And like, yeah, do you remember that? Would it be a big deal to turn up in a magazine?
It's weird because, you know, the magazines, it's whoever the publishers or anything else, you know, whoever their hard on is for that week, you know, that's who they're going to publish anyway, you know, regardless of, you know, the talent or what they're doing or anything else like that. You know, I don't hold a lot of stock in the dirt sheets or, you know, the all the newsletters and all that other, you know, stuff. You know, it is what it is. You know, you're going to have people that love you. You're going to have people that hate you. So, you know, I don't hold, you know, much into it. As long as I keep working steadily, I got to be doing something right.
Yeah, I think this was an issue of Wrestling Superstars when they were doing, like, top 20 teams. And I think you guys were, like, 17.
I don't know. That's good, though. I'll take 17.
Now, one thing I remember is you and Mosh on the WF show as the Spiders taking on Smoking Guns, or was it the Body Donnas?
Yeah, well, what we did is when we were still down in USWA for Jerry Lawler and stuff like that, you know, from time to time we would come up and do job matches and everything. The experience that you get from going to, you know, the big show is what we want to call WWF, WWE. It's the big show. It's the NFL of wrestling. It is, you know, where everybody wants to get to and everything else. So if you have an opportunity, regardless of what you're going to be doing for them, you're going to go. You can't learn that experience that you get from being in front of the lights, being around the talent that's around there. You know, sitting next to guys in the locker room like The Undertaker and Yokozuna and, you know, Big John Studd. And, you know, you don't get that experience like from King Kong Bundy sitting there listening to these guys talk about experiences and life on the road and stuff. You can't buy that kind of experience. You just can't. So anytime that we ever had a chance to go up there, we jumped on it. You know, it was that easy. You know, did it hurt us? Did it prevent us from making it? No, absolutely not. It probably helped us because everybody already knew who we were, and then we came up with the hit. You know, then we got the headbanger thing, and it was just something that worked. So, you know, all them. It's funny because when you were back at that time and you were labeled a job guy or you were on TV doing jobs and stuff like that, you're going to be a guy that never makes it to, you know, you'll never get a full-time contract and you'll never, you know, be anything in wrestling because you'll always be labeled a job guy. You know, that necessarily doesn't work. So that's not true.
Yeah, I was looking at the reason I was asking because the match stood out for me at the time because you guys got a lot of offense in for, you know, guys that weren't a part of the roster.
Well, with the Body of Adonis, I mean, I was good friends with Chris Candido. I mean, I was real good friends. He came from the Monster Factory. We knew Tom Pritchard. You know, we were good friends with them. So, I mean, at the time, when you're close to these guys, you know, they also want to, you know, help move people along and help, you know, help their careers and stuff like that, because that's only going to help them, you know, in the long run, having more people to wrestle, different people to work with, and things like that. So, yeah, they gave us probably more offense than most, you know, so they could take a look at us and look, see what we had and stuff like that. So, yeah, that's probably right.
All right. You know, you guys had a lot of cool double teams, especially at that point in the 90s when it seemed like that a lot of tag teams were getting kind of homogenized. They didn't seem to have as many double teams as they did like in the 80s. Like you would have that superplex thing. How would y'all work those double teams out?
Well, it's funny, when we first started tagging together, we got, you know, because Jim Cornette used to come down to the Monster Factory, you know, once a month, once, you know, every 2 months. He would come down there a lot because he was good friends with Larry Sharp and Chris Candido. So he would visit the school for the shows a lot. And he always told us, if you guys want to be a tag team, watch some of the old tapes. We would watch, you know, the Rockers. We would watch Ricky and Robert, the Rock and Roll Express. We would watch the Midnight Express. We would watch, you know, the Legion, you know, Hawk and Animal. We would watch the Road Wars. We would watch, you know, the Freebirds. We would watch a lot of the older tag teams, and we would take bits and pieces, because that's what makes tag team wrestling special for me, is that aspect of it, because you can't do that by yourself. You know, some of the coolest things, you know, that you can do is you can do it with somebody else. So, you know, we took a lot of stuff. We watched a lot of tape and stuff like that. And, you know, we would always try stuff out of the school. The first couple of times that we did the stage dive, which is Chaz does the power bomb, I do the leg drop off the top rope, which is our finish, is the first person to ever take that was D'Lo Brown. Can't tell you the number of times I sat on his face trying to get that timing down and everything else. But, you know, it's something that it worked itself out. And, you know, that move, it was something that I dreamt about the night before and wrote it down, woke up in the middle of the night, wrote it down, and tried it out in the school. It's a weird thing to describe, but, you know, when you're in training and stuff like that, I always slept with a notepad next to my bed, because you would lay in bed and you would dream different moves. And 9 times out of 10, when you wake up the next day, you forget about it. It's just normal. But I would wake up and I would write it down, and then I would get back to sleep. I'd wake up and I've had like 4 or 5 moves written down on this pad next to my bed and go, "What the hell is this from?" So, yeah, we got quite a bit of from, you know, watching the old tapes and also doing that.
Now, on the first episode of Shotgun Saturday Night, you guys debuted as Brother Love's tag team, the Sisters of Love. Was that was that just going to be a gimmick for the late night show, or were they actually thinking of using that as a full-time gimmick for you two?
Well, it was weird because it was a Vince McMahon creation. And, you know, back then, if Vince came up with a gimmick for you, one, you knew it was going to get pushed and you were going to be used a lot on TV. Two, you were just happy that Vince recognized, hey, he saw something in you. He's like, hey, I want to, you know, do something with these guys. I want to give them this name. So you were just excited for those two facts alone. What was told to us is when we first started doing it is, what Vince was going to do is he was going to wrap both gimmicks into one. He was going to have us do, you know, the Sisters of Love, you know, on the SmackDown shows, the late night show, and then the other shows we were going to do the Headbangers, and then all of a sudden it was going to evolve into each other, you know, and it was going to come out by going, these guys are so crazy, so nuts, so off the wall, they don't care what they wear. You just want to get in there and, you know, bang some heads. Look at these guys. They're wearing nun outfits, you know. But, you know, as certain things happen, you know, the church got involved and got several pieces of mail to the office, you know, from the Christians and everything else. So you know, Vince did what he thought was right and stopped it. So,
how was Brother Love to work with?
Bruce was, he was great. I mean, smart, brilliant, taught us a lot. I mean, you know, taught us a lot about, you know, tag team wrestling and everything else. Because you got to figure that guy, he's been in a business for, you know, back then, forever. I mean, you know, he was just, you know, he would put us in the right places and, you know, explain to us, you know, when you guys are doing this, cut off the ring, do this, do that. You know, he's been around, he's seen the best of the best. So, and, you know, and we got really close and good friends with Bruce. And, you know, he's just, you know, one of those great guys. You know, everybody says, everybody always has stories about, oh, Bruce is this and Bruce is that. Never, I still to this day, I couldn't tell you a bad thing about Bruce Prichard.
All right. Now, a few months into this, you were working as the Headbangers, and you worked against Doug Furness and Phil LaFon a few times.
Uh-huh.
Now, in another interview I saw with the Godwins, they said that the Furness and LaFon were very difficult to work with.
They were difficult to work with because they were mostly overseas wrestlers. Like they were,
yeah.
You know, their whole background was from Japan. So it was a little bit harder for them to get, I guess, Americanized to the American style of wrestling and stuff like that. And so they were a little bit harder to work with. You know, sometimes you have to adapt to their style. You know, it was kind of, you know, a mesh of both that we tried to always do with them. You know, we were trying to do spots, but then we would also try to do their style and with the kicks and the throws and stuff like that. That's, you know, kind of what we did. But, yeah, it was a little bit difficult because, you know, they were, you know, in the Japanese style mode more than the American style.
I noticed when I was watching tapes, you know, because I watch a lot of old wrestling, and I would watch them in Japan, and it was strange because they would show a lot of charisma and personality in the Japanese matches, but when they got to the WWF, it seemed like they lost something.
Well, you know what it is over there is the crowd has no charisma. The crowd has no reaction. So there's no crowd feedback over there like there is here. Here the crowd is very boisterous, very loud, very there. They're very right there. They let you know what's going on. Over there, you know, they sit there, they take everything in, they process it. They, you know, they get excited for pinfalls and kickouts and stuff like that. You know, every now and then for a big move, they'll give a woo. But they're not as boisterous. They're not in your face yelling at you and stuff like that. You know, I've worked Japan, you know, quite a few times, and that's how I took it. You know, it wasn't, you didn't work the crowd over in Japan. You worked your opponent. Now, over here, you work your opponent and the crowd. So.
One thing is that I noticed, I was thinking about this in 98 for you guys after you lost the WWF tag titles. You had a feud with the Rock and Roll Express and Insane Clown Posse later in the year. How was it working with the Rock and Roll Express?
Legendary. You know, they're one of the tag teams that we used to watch tapes on and, you know, get moves from and, you know, just watch the tag team theory, you know, from them and stuff like that. So it was great. I mean, especially back then, you know, Ricky and Robert taught us a lot. We were with them also in Smoky Mountain Wrestling before we went up to the WWE. And, you know, it's guys like that that paved the way for us, that gave us some knowledge, gave us feedback, you know, gave us the experience to be able to do what we, you know, that we love to do. You know, and that's kind of where we sit now is, you know, after coming back together, you know, a year ago, year and a half ago, you know, we're ready to give back. I still feel that we have, you know, plenty left in us. You know, all we need is, you know, the opportunity, the chance to prove, you know, I guess, to either one of the companies that we can still do what we say we do. You know, I personally am in the best shape that I've ever been in my life. Very extremely proud of that, because I was never one that watched what I eat. You know, I wasn't a big gym rat and stuff like that. And I'm very conscious of, you know, what I put in my body now, and what I eat, what I, you know, how I work out and everything else. And, you know, after I left the WWF, I didn't wrestle for 12 years. So I may be in my early 40s, but I have a body and the wear and tear on my body as a 30-year-old. So that's why I still feel like we have more to offer and that we could really have a good, you know, 5 years left in us to give back, to contribute to, you know, one of the federations. I really think that we could.
Now, later in the year, when you were feuding with the oddities, you were working a lot with Insane Clown Posse, and I noticed that that angle ended, you know, that whole thing ended rather abruptly, like the Insane Clown Posse just disappeared. Do you know what the story was there?
Well, what was going to happen is the Insane Clown Posse came in. They have a music background, of course. You know, us with being Headbangers is a music background, of course. And what was going to happen is the Insane Clown Posse wanted to be with us. They wanted to, the Headbangers and ICP wanted to have a run together. So when Vince wanted to put them with the Oddities and then have them switch over to us, you know, mid-story and stuff like that, it didn't happen fast enough, I guess, for them. They were very, very new in the business. This was before they ever went to WCW or anything else. This was their first experience in the wrestling business. So, you know, they may have went about it the wrong way because, you know, from what we heard, now, don't know how much of this is the truth. What we heard is every time we were doing TVs, they would always be, you know, talking to Vince about, oh, we're going with the Headbangers, we're going with the Headbangers, we really need to switch with the Headbangers, we really, you know, we need to be with... You don't tell Vince what to do as a talent. You can suggest things, but you don't tell him that you need to do something. It's just not how it was. At least that's not how it was for us. So, you know, finally, Vince came up to us and he goes, these guys won't be back tomorrow. I want you guys to go out there and, you know, make sure they don't come back tomorrow. So that was when we called them out and had a match. And, you know, those guys, they took everything that we could give them. And we've worked with them recently in the past year. They have their own federation. It's called JCW, Juggalo Championship Wrestling. You know, and they thanked us. They thanked us for, you know, bringing them into the business the way we did and everything else. There's, you know, there was no hard feelings. There was no heat between either one of us. It was business. It was, you know, our jobs. So, you know, they went on and went to WCW and had a great thing down there. So, you know, all the stories that there was heat between the Headbangers and, you know, ICP was just, you know, something, again, that was made up from the dirt sheets and, you know, these columns and everything else. So that's why I never held much weight into them.
All right. We're running out of time. The last thing I'm going to ask with what little time we got left is, you and Mosh, y'all kind of disappeared for a few months early in 99, then the Beaver cleavage gets started. You know, and it ended kind of abruptly.
I was out, I had, I dislocated my knee, and I tore my ACL and my medial meniscus. So I went in and had my ACL replaced, and then I started coming back, and I had to get my medial meniscus also removed. So I was out for about 9 months. Now, they didn't want Chaz just to sit home and do nothing, so they came up with something for him to do, you know, until I came came back and everything else, so they had him grow out his hair, did the whole Beaver Cleavage thing, and then they started that GTV thing, where that GTV was supposed to be me spying on him and letting him know, hey, look what she's doing to you, blah, blah, blah. You know, dump that chick and let's just go do our thing again. So that's why that ended up so abruptly.
Okay, so it was always intended for, that was just something to kill time until you got back.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
All right, yep. Let me ask, what was the deal with the bras?
Yeah, it was the Vince thing. It's funny when I use the example of Zack Ryder. Zack Ryder has done nothing but get himself over since day one that he's been with WWE. We did the same thing. We've never really gotten a big, huge push when we were on TV or anything else like that. You know, we went out there, the fans got us over. The fans have gotten Zack Ryder over. So Vince knew he could do anything and everything he wanted to us to, and not have the fans shit on us. And so no matter what he did, no matter how many times we lost or what we dressed like or what we looked like or anything else, what we came out as, he knew the fans were always going to be there for us. Kind of like the same thing he does with Zack Ryder. It's I don't know. It's a Vince thing. Vince thought it would be, you know, different to change up our outfits and get a little bit more edgier and stuff like that. So, you know, came up. He always had a thing with us, I guess, and, you know, breast assists and stuff because, you know, we had the whole boob thing when we did the Flying Nuns, and then he wanted us to have the boobs as the headbangers. I don't know what it was. Maybe we just looked like guys that needed to have boobs. I don't know. But, hey, your boss tells you to do something, you're going to do it. That's how it was.
Yeah, it was funny. I was watching on the on-demand that they have, the Royal Rumble 2000, and you guys came out, and my nephew looked at me. He's nine years old. He says, why are those guys wearing bras? And I just told him, I said, well, it's unnerving for their opponents.
It's because we can. That's why.
All right, man, I know you got to get going soon. I just want to thank you again for coming on the show. It was a lot of fun.
All right, man, no problem, anytime.
All right, man, you have a good night.
All right, take care.
You too.
Next week on the Blue Rookie.
Merciful Martini! I've been knocked up by my arch nemesis, Corporal Chloroform! Must reach GHB packet and slip it into his beverage!